Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Joseph Callinger, the Shoemaker of Philadelphia. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. The Shoemaker of Philadelphia, the most fucked up criminal you've never heard of. In the quiet neighborhoods of 1970s Philadelphia, there was a man who knew the shape of a person's soul by the wear on their heels. He was a master craftsman, a husband, and a father of seven. To his neighbors, he was just the Shoemaker. But inside the mind of Joseph Callinger, the world was fracturing. That's because Joseph didn't just see leather and souls. He saw a floating, disembodied head named Charlie, who whispered divine commands. He didn't just hear the city streets. He heard a calling to, quote, purify the world through a series of rituals so bizarre and brutal that they teetered on the macabre. But the most chilling part of the story isn't just what Joseph did. It's who he took along with him. Imagine a father waking his 12-year-old son in the middle of the night, not for a fishing trip or a ball game, but to go on a divine mission of home invasions, torture, rape, and murder. Tonight on Dead Souls, we peel back the shoe leather to reveal the rot beneath. We're exploring the life of Joseph Callinger, a man who was broken by his own childhood, only to forge his son into a weapon of his own delusion. Let's get into it. Joseph Lee Brenner III was born on December the 11th, 1935, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. During this time, the Boulder Dam, now known as the Hoover Dam, had just been completed. Further, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the U.S. Social Security Act, providing employment compensation for the American public. In April 1935, the Great Plains of the United States were struck by one of the worst dust storms in U.S. history. The storm would come to be known as, quote, the Black Sunday dust storm. It passed through the states of Oklahoma and Texas, further devastating farms and infrastructure already ravaged by the wider Dust Bowl. People who witnessed the dust storm stated that on that afternoon, a massive black cloud quickly engulfed the area. It caught most people off guard, and they had to race against the storm to find shelter. Also, during this year, in New York City, the first public housing project was launched. The Pan American Airways, so-called flying boat named the China Clipper, embarked on the first U.S. Trans-Pacific airmail delivery flight. The plane left Almeida in California and landed in Manila in the Philippines, after more than 7 days of travel. It successfully delivered 110,000 pieces of mail. It picked up mail intended for the United States and made the 7-day journey back to the continental United States. The Second Italo-Ethiopian War began this year, after Italy invaded Ethiopia in an attempt by their leader, Benito Mussolini, to expand the Italian Empire. The invasion of Ethiopia by Italy put a spotlight on the ineffectiveness of the League of Nations, which had been unable to stop Italy's attack and unable to agree on what actions to take against the belligerent nation. Sanctions had been imposed on Italy due to the invasion, but they largely remained ineffective. Allied troops would liberate Ethiopia later in 1941. The Second World War was already brewing, however. The first experimental radar system was developed in the United Kingdom. Driver tests were also introduced in Britain for the first time. The so-called people's car, and Ted Bundy's preferred ride, the Volkswagen Beetle, was launched in Germany. Toyota cars were coming off of the assembly line in Japan, and the United States first developed the helicopter. 1935 was also the first year canned beer was sold, definitely something which would catch on in popularity. Interestingly, this is also the same year that Alcoholics Anonymous was founded, also in the United States. An earthquake hit what is now modern-day Pakistan, killing 26,000 people. Persia was renamed Iran. And the Penguin Publishing Company, created in the UK by Alan Lane, was founded. Lane wanted to make affordable yet easily accessible versions of contemporary literature after having been personally disappointed by the selection of available and affordable books at the time. So in the summer of 1935, Penguin released their first 10 paperbacks, and within a year, they had sold over 1 million books in the UK alone. And finally, some notable people who were also born in this year were Jerry Lee Lewis, Julie Andrews, Woody Allen, Sonny Bono, the Dalai Lama, Elvis Presley, and the great, great actor Donald Sutherland. Side note, comment or send me a DM if you know who Vernon Pinkley is. So, this was essentially the atmosphere and culture of the world that Joseph was born into. His parents were Joseph Lee Brenner Jr. and his wife Judith. When Joseph was just 2 years old, Judith put him in a boarding house of sorts, because his father had abandoned them both. At this boarding house, his mum Judith did at least visit him once a week. Well, at first at least. Now, some of the sources that I have read stated that Judith abandoned the family and that it was Joseph Jr. who put their baby into the boarding house because he was unwilling to raise him as a single father, such was the stigma at the time. But I couldn't find a source for this outcome which was entirely reliable. Irrespective, it was documented that Joseph still developed separation anxiety, which is an important facet to remember for later on in the story. Now, according to Radford University, Joseph was then placed on the Catholic adoption list because his mother decided that she could not care for him, which supported the theory that it was his dad who abandoned the family. Judith was unable to find another husband and could not make enough money to financially support both her and her son. Back in the 1930s, it was incredibly difficult for a single mother, as I'm sure you can all imagine. There was no welfare, significantly less job opportunities, especially for women, and absolutely no childcare. Without a husband to provide for you, there was not a lot of options. In 1939, when Joseph was 4 years old, he was officially adopted by Stephen and Anna Kallinger. The couple were Austrian immigrants, and both in their early 40s. Sources say that Judith later tried to bribe the Kallingers into giving her son back, but the Kallingers refused. You see, I wish I could tell you that the young Joseph had a wonderful childhood, and that he was all the better for staying with the Kallingers, that his story had a happy ending. But that's sadly not the case. I mean, I wouldn't be discussing this story if it was, right? Stephen and Anna horrifically abused Joseph from the get-go. Stephen beat him mercilessly with a leather strap, and Anna beat him with a wooden spoon. This wasn't occasionally for misbehaving. This was regularly for almost anything that the couple were annoyed with. Neighbours said that the couple was seen flogging Joseph, and also beating him with a hammer. In fact, when Joseph was just 5 years old, another neighbourhood boy heard Joseph use the word fuck, and he told Joseph's parents about it. Because of this, he was beaten by both, and it was reported that Joseph was beaten by Stephen and Anna every single day for a whole week. The couple never actually told Joseph what the word meant, or even why he was being physically punished day after day. Indeed, when Joseph was just 6 years old, he was beaten so badly that he suffered a hernia and had to have surgery at the hospital to repair it. Stephen and Anna told him that he had to have surgery for his, quote, bird, to keep it small and to ensure that it didn't work. Bird, of course, referred to Joseph's penis. At 7 years old, Joseph stole a book of prayers from his school and was caught by a teacher. His punishment from his parents was being forced to kneel on sandpaper for an hour every night for a week. Sometimes his parents switched it up from sandpaper. Sometimes they forced him to repeatedly kneel on jagged rocks. He was also locked inside the closet. He was burned with irons and even starved to the point where he ate his own feces. When Joseph was 8 years old, he asked his mother if he could go with other children on a class field trip to the zoo. Her response was to hit him across the head with a hammer 4 times. Shortly after this, while his mother was chasing him around the house with a broom, Joseph began beating his own head against the wall and tables, which took Anna aback somewhat. When Joseph was going on 9 years old, he was held at knife point by some older boys from his neighborhood. One of them performed oral sex on him, while another held the knife to his throat. It's fair to say Joseph had a really shitty and bleak childhood. He became very rebellious and regularly raged against his teachers and his parents as much as he could, irrespective of the punishments he faced. Joseph's parents didn't bother to acknowledge him on his 9th birthday, so he went to school that day with a knife and cut holes into his classmates' coats. Just a few years later, he was stealing money from his parents in an attempt to make friends by taking the neighborhood kids to watch movies in the cinema. Predictably, his parents discovered the missing money and punished him by burning his fingers on the stove. Now, what Joseph learned from this particular torturous punishment wasn't that he shouldn't steal, but that the pain was tolerable because he had made friends that would go see movies with him. So he continued to take money from Stephen and Anna. This cycle of him stealing money from his parents and then them burning his fingers on the stove happened with some regularity before he finally stopped taking their money. Now, as Joseph entered puberty and he became sexually aware, he would cut a hole in the wall of his bedroom for the purposes of masturbation. It was a sort of glory hole, but with no one on the other side. Instead, he would look at photographs of both men and women, then use the hole to gratify himself. But as Joseph's life trauma began to manifest into him, he began needing a knife at his own wrist or throat in order to reach orgasm while masturbating. That evolved into him using the knife to cut and stab at the photos in order to finish, evolving his sexual appetite into an association with violence. At 13 years old, Joseph was able to convince his parents to let him go to a summer camp for 2 weeks. Hell knows how he managed to do that. They must have had an out-of-character moment, because surprisingly, they actually agreed. While Joseph was there, he stole a scope off of a rifle that the staff had. He took it apart and kept the lens from within it. He did this because it, quote, made things look bigger. I think you can work out what I'm saying with this. A couple of weeks after he returned home from said camp, Joseph said that he began hearing voices. Voices telling him to cut someone with a knife, to make them bleed. So, not wanting to ignore the voices, of course, Joseph boarded a bus armed with a 6-inch blade. Quietly reading at the back of the bus, he saw another boy exit the bus, and he decided to follow him. He caught up to him, and armed with said knife, he ordered the boy to walk into a wooded area near a river, and demanded he take his trousers off. Joseph didn't harm the boy. He eventually just ran off. But he enjoyed the new experience and power. Over the course of the next few months, this developed into a habit, and Joseph would pull this stunt several more times on random boys. But the very last victim's experience wasn't so easy. Joseph decided to reenact exactly what had been done to him when he was younger by the boys in his neighborhood. He put the other boy's penis in his mouth and went as far as to bite down, all while holding the boy at knife point. Whilst he didn't cut the boy, there was blood. Lots of blood. From where Joseph had bitten down. Now, it was also when Joseph was around 13 years old that he got the opportunity to play the lead part in the school play. The play was A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, and he actually showed some talent. His performance was well received, and Joseph got a huge rush out of taking part in the play and performing in front of an audience. After this, Joseph had seriously thought about either becoming a playwright or an actor. And of course, when he shared this interest with his parents, well, they simply laughed at him and belittled him for even wanting to pursue either career. They called him a sissy, and their mockery was cutting and deeply affected teenage Joseph. At 15 years old, while at the cinema, the only place his parents would actually allow him to go on Saturdays, he met a girl named Hilda Bergman. The pair began dating very quickly, although Joseph's parents were completely against him doing so. As such, they told him that they forbade the relationship. But Joseph continued seeing Hilda anyway, and this would be when he would have his first consensual sexual experience. But in that same year, Joseph, he would later say, was told by God that he had chosen him for a special mission. The mission was that Joseph was to heal people and save them through their feet. These days, this may have involved Joseph setting up an OnlyFans. But for Joseph, over the next 11 years, well, he conducted over 40,000 so-called experiments on people's feet. You see, Joseph was a trained cobbler, a skill that he learned from his father, who owned a shoe shop. Joseph had been working there most of his life, and because his parents would not leave him alone about ending his relationship with Hilda, in 1951, at nearly 16 years of age, Joseph decided to move out of his parents' home and into a flat on his own, although he continued to work in his father's shop. This would be a time in young Joseph's life that would actually be somewhat positive and happy for him. He and Hilda were still together, and they were heavily sexually active, but not unlike most teenagers. He finally had also made some decent friends, and it was at this point that he began playing poker and pool with those friends. Joseph began drinking alcohol in 1953 when he was 17 years old, and he dropped out of high school. This was a pretty common practice for the time. Dropping out of school meant that he could now work full-time at the family shoe shop. Things moved pretty quickly for Joseph after this. He and Hilda got married, and he had two children straight away. Even though Joseph and Hilda's marriage produced two children, it was hardly a harmonious and happy relationship. It was rife with domestic abuse, arguments, and bickering. Hilda finally garnered the courage to leave Joseph and went to be with another man. And not long after, Joseph was hospitalized with a suspected brain lesion. Tests were performed, but they revealed that he only had a, quote, psychopathological nervous disorder. A more common term for this would be generalized anxiety disorder, the most common anxiety disorder diagnosed in Western countries. Joseph was released from the mental health facility. Now, a 22-year-old Joseph very quickly married a second time to a woman named Betty. They went on to have five children together, bringing his total to seven children. At this point, that same year, 1958, he set fire to his own house, purely, he said, for amusement. He collected the insurance from it, of course. Once again, Joseph was incredibly abusive towards his new family. Towards his children, he often deferred to the same methods which his own parents had used against him as a child. He attempted to set his own house on fire a second time in 1959, but this attempt proved fruitless, and he was committed to a state psychiatric hospital shortly after this, when he attempted to take his own life. Psychiatric facility admittance is very commonplace following an attempt on one's life. But to add fuel to the fire, Joseph already had existing mental health concerns, so it was vital that doctors monitored him. And thus, this would become a pattern, being committed to mental health facilities on and off throughout his 20s and into his mid-30s, often for attempts on his own life, amnesia, and for setting fires. A pattern of behaviour emerging that would remain for over 15 years. In 1972, when Joseph was 36 years old, in a fit of rage, he branded his oldest daughter with a hot iron for running away from home. He was then arrested for child abuse and charged further with the abuse of three of his other children after they had gone to the police station and reported additional physical abuse against themselves by Joseph. Somehow, though, Joseph was able to get his wife Betty to support his story that the children had all, in fact, attempted to run away, and the abuse was merely punishment and not physical abuse. Nevertheless, the authorities charged Joseph, and after he was assessed and found competent to stand trial, he was found guilty of child abuse and sentenced to 4 years probation with mandatory psychiatric treatment. Now, while Joseph was in jail awaiting trial, he was tested and given a score of 82 on an IQ intelligence test. Now, the average IQ score in the United States is around 100, so this placed Joseph below average. Further, he was also diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia at the same time, which only added to his struggles and challenges. In fact, the state recommended that Joseph be supervised by the court while he was with his family. But it was 2 years later, when Joseph was in his late 30s, that he began regularly hallucinating and began to experience two-way conversations with these daylight hallucinations. In particular, a disembodied head named Charlie. Joseph also received personal orders from God. These orders included demands to murder young boys and sever their genitals. Joseph told his 13-year-old son Michael about the orders that he had received from God, and that he would need his help to carry out these divine instructions. It would seem entirely reasonable and realistic to explain how Michael had been completely horrified by this and sought medical help for his father. But that didn't happen. Instead, 13-year-old Michael was more than willing and cooperative, telling his father, quote,
"I'll be glad to do it, Dad."
Now, just 11 days later, Joseph, with the help of his son Michael, murdered Jose Collazo, a Puerto Rican youth from Philadelphia. The father and son duo tortured Collazo and cut off his genitalia. That same month, Joseph took out a $45,000 life insurance policy on two of his other sons. He and Michael decided to murder his own 13-year-old son and brother Joey. Michael and Joey were twins, both 13. The first attempt to kill him had Joseph trying to get Joey to walk backwards off of a cliff while pretending to try to take his picture. That didn't work. It was a fairly idiotic and comedic plan to begin with, and poorly conceived. But Joseph then tried trapping Joey in a burning trailer, but the boy was able to escape. Then, 3 days after trying to kill him in a fiery inferno, they were successful in ending his life. They drowned him at a demolition site. Joseph reported Joey as missing. He said that he had run away, but his remains were found around a week later among some rubble at the demolition site. The cause of death couldn't be officially determined. The life insurance company refused to pay out on the policy, however, suspecting that things were not what they seemed to be. It seems Joseph and Michael now got comfortable with their methodology after these first two murders. And in November 1974, the pair began a full-on crime spree that encompassed Philadelphia, Baltimore, and New Jersey. For more than 6 weeks, the pair broke into families' homes, the first being in New Jersey, but no one had been home at the time. The second home they broke into, however, resulted in Joseph sexually assaulting the woman who lived within. A month later, the father-son duo kidnapped four women from Philadelphia while the ladies were playing bridge and stole $20,000 worth of their valuables in cash. They both also held a woman hostage in her own home, in Homeland, Maryland, and forced her to perform sexual acts on Joseph at gunpoint. All of this, not only being witnessed by his own son, but the son was a willing participant. They forced themselves into a home in Leona, New Jersey, armed with knives and guns, and took eight hostages, hostages whom they tied up with cords cut from their own electrical appliances. Most of the people were forced to take their clothes off. Out of the eight, they murdered one. She was 21-year-old Maria Fasching, a nurse. Joseph cruelly slashed her throat in front of her family. Thankfully, one of the others, who was bound, was able to free themselves and ran to a neighbor's house to get help. Joseph and two of his sons, Michael 13 and 11-year-old James, were later arrested in their own home. The authorities had linked the crime from a blood-soaked shirt. Joseph was a strong and definite suspect in the crime, but the authorities couldn't decide which son to take in, because it was said that Michael and James both looked so much alike. The police ultimately determined that Michael had been Joseph's accomplice and allowed James to go free. The assumption was a correct one. Joseph and Michael were charged with kidnapping and rape. Joseph was further charged with three counts of murder, along with his son, Joey, and another neighborhood boy. Joseph pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, stating that God himself had given him the orders to kill. The courts decided that while Michael was delinquent, he was still salvageable. The murder charges against Michael were dismissed in a plea deal, where he would plead guilty on two counts of robbery instead. Michael's punishment was to be placed on probation until his 25th birthday. He served his sentence, changed his name, and moved out of the state, vanishing into history. As for Joseph, he was given another psychiatric evaluation, and the doctor concluded that he had known right from wrong while committing his crimes. Thus, Joseph was indeed competent to stand trial. Joseph's first trial was declared a mistrial due to issues with jury selection. But during his second trial, he was charged with four counts of robbery, four counts of false imprisonment, and one count of burglary. While he was testifying, he stated that he had periods where he had no memory of things, and told the jury that God communicated with him and told him to do the things that he had done. He also reiterated that he was the Son of God and that he had existed previously as a butterfly. Joseph was, of course, found guilty on all charges and sentenced to 30 to 80 years in prison. While in prison and awaiting his third trial, this one for his crimes in New Jersey, Joseph started acting out strangely in an attempt to draw attention to his mental illness. Psychological evaluators determined that he was faking his symptoms. The third trial for the New Jersey murder of Maria Fasching found Joseph guilty, and he was subsequently sentenced to life in prison. He began trying to end his own life whilst incarcerated, including once setting himself on fire. He also assaulted a fellow inmate and somehow managed to start a fire within his own cell block. Prison authorities decided to move him to a mental hospital in Weymouth, Pennsylvania, a facility for the criminally insane, as they like to label them in the United States. It took Joseph no time before he attempted to murder another inmate there, completely unprovoked. Later, he slashed the throat of an unsuspecting prisoner, but luckily for them, they survived. In 1988, while still in prison, the now 53-year-old conducted a television interview where he expressed his unending desire to slaughter every person on earth and commit suicide, only to, quote, become God. Now, this wouldn't be a Dead Souls episode if I didn't share some of that interview with you, would it? As it happens, the interviewer is true crime sensationalist Geraldo. Enjoy.
currently serving a life sentence for sex-related murder here at the State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, just outside Scranton, Pennsylvania.
I'm a patient person, got a good listening ear, and try to help people.
You're a patient with a good ear, and you try to help people.
Yes.
When you're not trying to murder them.
Yes.
When Callinger's reign of terror ended, three were dead, including his 14-year-old son.
You murdered your own son?
Yes, I did.
Why did you do that?
He was a sacrifice. I was to murder 3 million people on planet Earth. And he was a sacrifice to see if I could murder one of my own. At the end of murdering all the people on Earth, I was going to murder my own family and then take my own life and become God.
What do you think of the death penalty?
I'm opposed to it.
The state has no right to take your life, but you can murder other people?
I don't think anyone has the right to take a life.
Except you?
When I'm under hallucination, I do.
These voices from God, these hallucinations, do you still experience them?
Yes, I do.
Often?
Often.
Do you ever feel violent?
Yes, I do.
What do you feel like doing?
Killing people.
You still feel like killing people?
Yes.
Describe the feeling that you get when you feel like killing people.
Well, last March 11th, I was hallucinating, and I took a razor blade and I cut a man's throat.
Here in the hospital?
Here in the hospital.
Do you think you'd murder me, Joe?
Yes.
That's gruesome, Joe. That's horrible.
Yes, it is.
And you don't blame me if I say I hope you never get out of this place.
I hope I never do either.
In 1991, Joseph would take part in multiple hunger strikes, and he spent the next 5 years in solitary confinement on constant suicide watch. Then, on March the 26th, 1996, at the age of 60 years old, Joseph Callinger died. There is some conflicted information as to what exactly Joseph died from. Some say he had a seizure, choked on his own vomit, and died in the prison infirmary, whilst other sources say he died of heart failure. Either way, after being on suicide watch for more than 11 years, Callinger was gone. I wish I'd been able to find some level of information about his biological parents and who they were as people. Did one of them have issues that would make Joseph genetically predisposed to violence? Did schizophrenia run in his biological family? Do you think Callinger could have been faking it long term? The severe mental and physical abuse that Callinger suffered at the hands of his adoptive parents certainly was enough to trigger lasting trauma. The fact that he was able to get his son Michael to be his partner in crime so willingly might suggest that there was some level of genetic component. But this is all conjecture, without medical records or access to the deceased. But with that being said, childhood mistreatment can be linked to later physical, psychological, and behavioral consequences, as well as cost to society as a whole. These consequences may be independent of each other, but they may also be interrelated. Some examples include stunted physical development of the child's brain, which leads to psychological problems such as low self-esteem, which could later lead to high-risk behaviors such as substance abuse. The outcome for each child vary widely and are affected by a combination of factors, including the child's age and developmental status when the mistreatment occurs, the type, frequency, duration, and severity of the mistreatment, and the relationship between the child and the perpetrator. Children who experience mistreatment often are affected by other adverse experiences, such as domestic abuse and poverty, and other factors which can make it difficult to separate the unique effects of mistreatment and trauma. The psychological health consequences of abuse and or neglect may occur immediately, such as brain damage caused by head trauma, but others can take months or even years to emerge and become apparent. There is a clear and direct link between physical abuse and physical health, but it is also important to recognize that abuse or neglect of any type can cause long-term physical and cognitive consequences. Childhood abuse has also been linked to a higher risk of a wide range of long-term future health problems, which can include diabetes, lung disease, malnutrition, vision problems, functional limitations, heart attacks, arthritis, back problems, high blood pressure, brain damage, migraine headaches, chronic bronchitis, cancers, strokes, bowel disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, and the list goes on. Child abuse and neglect has also been associated with certain regions of the brain failing to form appropriately. Those same areas failing to function or grow properly. A history of maltreatment may correlate with reduced volume and overall brain size and may affect the size and or function of the following brain regions. The amygdala, which is key for processing emotions. The hippocampus, which is central to learning and memory. The orbitofrontal cortex, which is responsible for reinforcement-based decision-making and emotional regulation. The cerebellum, which helps coordinate motor behavior and executive functioning. And the corpus callosum, which is responsible for left-right brain communication and other vital processes. Now, there have been some studies that show a level of evidence that children's brains may be able to recover with the help of appropriate interventions. If you are interested, look up Understanding the Effects of Mistreatment on Brain Development. We have seen children who have suffered abuse and have diminished executive functioning and cognitive skills, including self-control and mental flexibility. We have also seen quite poor mental and emotional health, such as depression, anxiety, and other psychiatric disorders. Children often have attachment and social difficulties, and an ever-present post-traumatic stress disorder, which is displayed as the persistent re-experiencing of the traumatic events related to the abuse. This can be avoiding people, places, and events, feeling fear or horror, anger, guilt, shame, and being easily startled and exhibiting hypervigilance, irritability, and other changes in mood. Post-traumatic stress disorder in children can lead to depression, suicidal ideation, substance abuse, oppositional and defiant behaviors. Again, this list is very long. I think it would be safe and a somewhat educated assumption to say that the abuse and trauma that Joseph Callinger experienced from both of his adoptive parents set him up for a bleak future and likely contributed to his mental health struggles and criminal behaviors. It really is paramount that children have positive upbringing and supportive parents, as the long-term effects, if not, can be irreversible and, such as in this case, extremely tragic. What are your thoughts on tonight's chronicle? Reach out. As always, let's discuss. Joseph Callinger died on March 26, 1996, at SCI Crescent near Altoona, Pennsylvania. Following Michael Callinger's completion of parole and the changing of his identity, his whereabouts remain unknown. Good night, everyone.